Welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the incredible Creekside Room, the speaker is Michael Pallett, and he will be speaking on Promised Land property titles. So, let's listen in on Michael Pallett.
I teach systematic theology at the Lutheran Seminary in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Canada. And also one of the areas of interest I have are theologies of liberation, and particularly Latin American aspects of that. So about once every 3 years I lead a travel seminar, also working with the Center for Global Education at Augsburg College in Minneapolis, down to some countries in Central America where we look at particular issues that involve the church in those areas. And again, the last 2 weeks of June, or more specifically June 16th to July 1st, I led a group down there that was looking at, again, issues of the church and social justice in Guatemala and Nicaragua, particularly concerned with indigenous peoples and returning refugees and internally displaced persons. And so this week, what I'd like to do is talk about some of those issues down there and also do some theological reflection on that in terms of what that might mean for us as Christians and people of God here in North America. I'm not an expert on Central America. I wouldn't pretend to be that. But I have spent some time studying those areas. And also, this was my fourth trip down there, so I'm becoming more familiar with some of the peoples and geography and so on and so forth. So we'll try to share some of those experiences and then, like I said, reflect theologically on them. What I want to do in this first section is, in this first session, is talk a little bit about the issues of land and land reform that are going on in Guatemala and Nicaragua. That it seems that always within Latin America in general, and certainly within Central America, one of the issues has always been land. Because since the time of the conquest, the great portions of land, and particularly the farmable or agrable land, has been handed over to just a few wealthy landowners and so on and so forth. And most of the people then are either serfs or tenant farmers on that land, and have had to get their own subsistence and living from eking out some kind of subsistence level on the sides of the mountains and so on and so forth. And so one of the issues that's always confronting the people of Central America is that issue of land reform. And in the two countries, it takes on two particular different aspects right now. And I'll talk about each one respectively. First of all, let me talk a little bit about Guatemala. And I'm not much of an artist, but I'll try to give you a map of Guatemala. So it's kind of flat on this side and goes up in. There's a panhandle over and down. I know it doesn't look quite like Guatemala, but think about this. Out here, this is the Atlantic Ocean. Over here is the Pacific Ocean. This is Mexico all the way around here. This is the little country of Belize, and there's still dispute. The Guatemalans claim that Belize is still part of Guatemala. Others don't. Down here in this area, we have El Salvador, and then over here, we have the Honduras. So this is kind of Central America in probably its most rough but imaginative forms. Now, the places where we were interested in were areas right in here. This is the place where there's a lot of refugee resettlement going on. Again, most of the coastal plains, here's the most agrable land. Here's where you have the biggest farms and the most productive farms on both coasts. That's where bananas are grown, cotton, a lot of vegetables are grown there now to be sent to the United States, like cabbage, broccoli, snow peas. Most of those things are grown along the coast. Up here in this area is the tropical jungle. I'll just call that the tropics. That now is again getting into forestry, and is a lot of deforestation is going on, a lot of poaching of the forests is going on, and particularly as you talk with many people, there's the accusations that the military is engaged in clandestine lumbering operations to sneak out particularly the exotic hardwoods like teak and mahogany and all of that into the United States and other places. So there's kind of a black market in forestry products, which supposedly the military is in on, and one wouldn't have a sense of doubting it. Down here is Guatemala City, and this is the more populous area of Guatemala. Up here are the high mountains, and in this whole area in here and in this mountain range is where you have a significant number of the indigenous peoples living who are of Mayan ancestry, the Mayas. This is also the area that the military, particularly in the 1980s, thought to be a security risk, so that within this particular area there were 440 villages that were totally destroyed, particularly at the time of the military dictator, General Efrain Rios Montt. You may have heard of him, or might remember the name. He is the one who initiated this plan of what they call there the scorched earth policy within Guatemala. In order to get rid of these indigenous peoples, he thought it was necessary to just totally eliminate them. And so they would go in. Usually the tactic that the army would use is that they would gather up the men of the village or the leaders of the village. Sometimes it would be women as well, particularly, let's say, if the woman was a Roman Catholic catechist, a teacher of peoples, or healthcare workers, teachers. They would round these people up. They would put them inside the church, which was usually the biggest and largest structure in the village. They would put them inside the church, and then they would firebomb the church and kill the people and mass graves. And all the other villagers would, kind of stand outside, watch. Sometimes they were forced to stand outside and watch, and then they too were shot. Or very often they had to flee for their own lives to ravines and literally live in the wilderness in order to survive. This was the practice in 440 villages. That's why, during this time, as you can see, many of these people fled to Mexico, and the state in Mexico known as Chiapas, which is where the uprisings have happened of about a year and a half ago. So these folks, many of these folks, fled to Mexico. Others of them again tried to go through the jungle and maybe snuck down into Guatemala City or over on the coast where they felt they were safe. Or many of them tried to seek refugee status and asylum in the United States. One of places like Phoenix and other places in Arizona, or particularly Los Angeles and Southern California, that at least right now, if one can trust census figures, outside of Guatemala City, where you will find the most Guatemalans per capita, is in Los Angeles. So there's a tremendous amount of people that immigrated. Some of the statistics, again, you can kind of be inundated with statistics, but in terms of these 440 villages destroyed, there are 1.5 million displaced people. Now, some of those people are the refugees in Mexico and elsewhere. Some of them are displaced within the country themselves, and the name given to them is they are called the internally displaced. It's the kind of situation that, let's say, your village was up here and it was destroyed, or you were running for fear of your life. What happened is you stayed out through the jungle or in the wilderness, and you worked your way down to here, and now you're living down here and you're trying to set up some kind of life for yourself, but you're still displaced. You're away from family, home, roots, land, perhaps, if you had a little 2-3 acre plot down here, basically, again, with nothing, trying to have a subsistence living. Since the 1980s, there have been over 80,000 killed in this scorched earth policy and devastation, and there have been over 45,000 people disappeared. And again, that notion of disappeared is a technical term in Guatemala and other countries in Latin America. That's one of the ways, again, that you are taken care of, that if you are seen to be a troublemaker, a rabble-rouser, a traitor, a subversive for the state, all of a sudden, some night, there's a knock on your door and there are people in ski masks or whatever that come in, they pick you up, they put you in some kind of usually 4x4 vehicle, Ford Ranger 4x4 or whatever, with the dark tinted windows, and you are taken away and you're never seen again. You've just simply disappeared. And that's often the way in which one handles political dissidents within Central America and South America. And in Guatemala, there are over 45,000 people like this. That's the case. Now, what has happened is that back in the late 80s, the different countries of Central America, as well as the United States, met at a place called Esquipulos. And there was an agreement called Esquipulos II, which tried to say that Central America needs to demilitarize and democratize. That's what the United States, if you will, wants to happen in Central America. Why does the United States want this? Well, the Cold War is over. So you can't go around in that sense saying that all of these folks who may oppose the government and military dictatorships are godless atheist communists seeking to overthrow this country and all of the free world and freedom and democracy will be going down the tubes. That particular line of thought and propaganda is no longer going to work with the collapse of the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe and so on and so forth. So now the policy is that the way in which Central America can still remain within the United States' economic sphere of influence is that it has to be drawn into its kind of trade circle once again. And so the whole notion of free trade, like the NAFTA agreement between Canada and the United States and Mexico, they're thinking about expanding that kind of understanding and taking it into Central America as well. But in order to do that, one has to have a stable political situation. How does one achieve that kind of stability? Well, through demilitarization, right, and taking away the threat of the military, and through a more democratic kind of process and democratic kind of rule. And so what's happened is very systematically they've been trying to bring that about in these countries and engage in particular peace processes and peace accords within all these countries to reach agreements and to establish some kind of constitution and democratic government. The way in which this has worked is that Costa Rica was first, because Costa Rica basically since 1948 said they were not going to have a standing army and have been more democratic. So that was the first country and easiest country to do. The second country they tried to work that in is Nicaragua, through the defeat of the Sandinistas and the bringing in of Violeta Chamorro as president and working out peace accords there between the Sandinista and the other side in that, and have brought that about. The third country they have tried that in is El Salvador, and again this March and in May there have been the elections. The peace process is beginning to, some people say, work, not work, in terms of it started with the ceasefire, the negotiations, the elections, and where it will go from here. The next country now in which this is happening is Guatemala. And Guatemala, the rebels, you know, quote unquote rebels, and government and military forces have signed a ceasefire, and now they are again trying to work out what they call a peace accord. There are three key items that are there in this peace accord. The first notion is, again, that sense of demilitarization. How is it that we get the military out of ruling the country and out of, again, threatening people? Two of the things that the military is noted for in Guatemala, but this was the case in El Salvador and whatnot, is that within each community, within each village, they would set up what we would call in English something like civil defense committees. These were basically civilians who were to play military roles within a village. And basically what they did is act as informers. And so the military could go to those people and say, well, who are the leaders in your community that might be organizing against the government? Who might be setting up workers' unions, trade unions? Is the teacher in your school ever critical about what the government or army says? What is the priest or minister saying in his sermons on Sunday? Right. And these people would simply inform the military, and again, right, if a person was determined to be too dangerous, they were simply eliminated. Usually, again, they were disappeared. So that kind of role of the military they want stopped. The second thing about the military that they want stopped is forced conscription. While it is in the Guatemalan Constitution that every 18-year-old is required to serve in the Guatemalan military for 2 years, obviously many men are not excited about serving in the military. So often what they do is, again, simply come into a village and take the young men into forced conscription and military service. Or they could stop a bus on the road, and again, particularly up here in the Highlands, they could simply stop a bus on the road. Let's say, like, we take our Greyhound bus from Wenatchee to Seattle, and as you're going out in some past Kashmir or whatever, and it's you know, kind of wild terrain, all of a sudden there would be a military group out there. It would stop the bus. It would have everybody get off the bus. It would note that all men between the ages of, well, they go down to about 12 or 13, between 12 and 13, right up to 30, 35, would simply be taken off the bus, would simply be escorted into a military vehicle. They would be taken away, and everyone else would be loaded back on the bus, and it goes on its way. You have just volunteered for 2 years in the army. That, again, that kind of forced conscription is what they want stopped. That's one of the key things of demilitarization in this peace accord. The second part of the peace accord that they're interested in is what they're calling a truth commission. And again, they've had these in El Salvador as well. This is to say they want to know who are the people responsible for the atrocities of the 80s. Who are the people, the higher ups, right? The generals, the political leaders, so on and so forth, who are responsible for the burning of these 440 villages, the killing of over 80,000 people, and so on. Who gave these orders? Now, again, that's a big sticking point in the negotiations, because obviously the military, which is probably the second most powerful force in Guatemala right now, and I'll talk about power structures tomorrow, the military obviously does not want to come to punishment for its actions and activities. So the sticking point there in negotiations is to say, yes, you can do your fact-finding and your fault-finding, but we don't want it such that the judicial system can kick in and these people can be prosecuted for their crimes. So what the military wants in this agreement, in this peace accord, is immunity for its leaders. Obviously, the other side does not want immunity. They want to see these people brought to justice. So there's the issue, bringing them to justice or immunity. And the third issue in all of this is land. What do we do with the land? Again, most of the land in Guatemala is in the hands of just a few people, and it's in great, huge land allotments called fincas. That's the singular one. It's a finca more than... And fincas are great big plantations. These can be banana plantations, cotton, coffee, all of that. But most of the people who own these fincas, while they might be Guatemalan citizens, usually don't live in Guatemala. Most of them live, for example, in Miami. Or sometimes a few live in Texas, maybe in Southern California, but usually Miami is the preferred place. Now, what these internally displaced people are asking, as well as these refugees who are now returning from their exile in Mexico, and some of them have been in Mexico now for as long as 12 to 14 years, right, so you can imagine in 12 to 14 years, if they did have any land, however small that plot may have been, that has just simply been either taken over by someone else who's a land squatter trying to make a subsistence living, or it has been incorporated into these huge fincas. And so, again, the issue in this peace accord is, how do we again engage in a just distribution of the land? Now there are two things that are being proposed. One is that the international community would set up a fund for the refugees such that they could purchase some land, even huge amounts of land, like one of these fincas, and begin to develop it for themselves within a cooperative movement and so on and so forth, and they would be helped to do that. In my trip here this last time, that's what I visited. I visited a finca that was called Chakula, which was sold to a group of 600 refugee, 120 families, so about 600 people, were able through an international grant to buy Chakula for about $3.5 million in U.S. funds. What they hope to do now is to develop that into their own farming community, where they will be raising cattle, they can do some coffee, it can be a forestry area, and so they're going to try to make a go of it. They have rechristened Finca Chakula into Nueva Esperanza. So for them, they are now going to live in the community that they call New Hope. And they came back from Mexico again with virtually nothing. Right? I mean, they had to flee for their lives into Mexico. They couldn't take any properties or anything they had with them. If they had a few chickens, a cow, whatever, that was all left behind. Again, going from Mexico back into Guatemala, the stipulations were such that they couldn't bring anything with them except only their personal materials. So again, things like clothing, and maybe cooking utensils and things like that were what they could bring. Everything else had to be left behind. And so here they are then, just settling back in on the land with hardly, if any, resources. And from there, trying to make a go of it. So it's starting with having to dig wells for potable water, putting up whatever huts they can at this point. Some of them are still living in simply plastic tarps, and they put up plastic tarps as a tent, and that's what you call home. Some of them have been able to find some of that corrugated roofing, like on the top of our chalets here, or lodges here. Those are the glamorous homes, if you can have corrugated sides and roofing. Usually they're little one-room homes or whatnot, little one-room huts. That's where they live. And that's the way in which, one of the ways in which they are trying to establish the land reform that is needed. The other way is simply through straight grants. Some of the peasants are asking the government to just simply say, give us land. After 500 years of domination and exploitation and repression from the scorched earth policy, from having been chased off of our lands and everything else, justice dictates that we simply receive some land in order to begin making a life for ourselves. And again, they're not requesting a lot. It's what we would consider like 3 to 5 acres. Right? They feel that with 3 to 5 acres they can support their family. And that's what they're asking for. So some of those things are beginning to happen. Those outright grants of land have not yet happened. The Guatemalan government has promised to consider it, but they've been promising to consider it for about the last 2 years. And so while we were there, again, in Guatemala City, in front of the governmental palace, out in its big courtyard, there are about 300 of these internally displaced peoples that just set up a little encampment as protest, and they were going to stay there and live there in front of the government palace in the square until the government reached some kind of decision, which again they hoped would be getting them the land. So that's kind of where the promises of land and property titles and land reform are in Guatemala at this present moment. Well, again, it's the kind of thing, remember, one of the focuses here is democratization. And so what you're trying to establish, or what you want the world to know, is that you are a quote-unquote democratic country, a free people have the right to protest and let their wants and needs be known. On the one hand, the government would like to do nothing more, or certainly again, let's say some military leaders would like to do nothing more than just simply cart all these people away and be done with it. But what kind of splash would that make in the international press? How would that go over in terms of the U.S. Congress to say, you know, 500 or 300 people were publicly taken away by the military from in front of the governmental palace in Guatemala City? Look at those human rights violations. What chance does Guatemala have in getting a good aid bill passed in the Congress the next time that issue of appropriation comes up? So you see, what happens now is that the peasants, the campesinos, the peasant farmers, the poor, the indigenous, what's happening in the last 10, 15 years is that they are getting politically sophisticated. And they know how one must work in order to get not only the ear of the Guatemalan government, but much more importantly, the ear of international governments, and particularly the ear of the U.S. government.
Now, the Catholic Church was really active with their catechists.
Yes.
And that was how they got some of this idea stuff going and taught the people.
Yes.
Are they, I'm thinking that Rigoberta Menchú's book, are they preaching religion as much as just social development? How strong is the Catholic Church?
The Catholic Church is not as strong in Guatemala as it used to be, for the simple fact that often within the 80s, the first target of this scorched earth policy were the catechists. Most of the catechists in this whole area of Guatemala, if you take it from the border here, right through this way, kind of the whole western half of Guatemala, most of the catechists in that region were killed. And so that was, and replaced by, and again, this was very, I mean, there's books and all of that, replaced by very fundamentalistic Protestant groups. Assemblies of God, Church of God, kind of Jimmy Swaggart kinds of organizations came down there. I mean, you can get the kind of thing there. There's a guy who I forget his name, but he's labeled as the Jimmy Swaggart of Guatemala, and the kind of thing that. That these folks are preaching to the peasants is again to say, well, you see, the reason all these terrible things have befallen you is because you are sinners. You are still pagans. And I'll get into this when we talk about the whole sense between the indigenous culture and some of its practices in relationship with Christianity. But these very fundamentalistic preachers say, you are sinners, right? You don't read the Bible enough. You don't believe in God enough. You don't pray enough. And so therefore, this is the punishment that God is sending upon you. So what you need to do, right, is not protest and or... But you just simply need to believe in God the way you're supposed to, and then these things won't happen to you anymore.
What is there within fundamentalism that would lead people who are fundamentalists to support terrorism?
because the fundamentalist mindset in this is still very much a kind of, if you will, black and white mindset, that one, the task of Christianity is saving souls, and it's otherworldly. And so in that sense, it really doesn't make any difference what happens to you here or what condition you're in. What's important is that when you die, your soul goes to heaven, so you live eternally with Jesus. That's all that counts. Everything else is immaterial.
Well, not much different than fundamentalism within Muslims and all the rest.
Right. No, I mean, there's a kind of formal character to fundamentalism. Yeah, I want to use fundamentalism here in a very precise sense. I'm not, if you will, people who are conservatives are fundies. There's that kind of specific structure. And one of the key things to fundamentalism is its otherworldliness, total concentration on the other world. This world is not important. The second thing with regard to fundamentalism, and this is where it mixes in with particularly, again, U.S. understandings of things, is that the fundamentalist mindset also has the notion of there is Christianity and democracy, which go together, and then there is atheism and communism, which go together. And for the fundamentalists, right, the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, the FMLN in El Salvador, the different opposition groups in Guatemala, Castro in Cuba, they are all godless, atheistic communists who are tools of Satan and will destroy your soul. And so therefore, again, right, the thing is, one of the reasons for their zeal, and they're still basically saying, listen to your government, obey your government, is because they categorize the opposition as godless communists. And it's still the case, as unbelievable as it may seem to us now, that we, while there, right, and when we met with some of these fundamentalist folks and military leaders, they still have a Cold War mentality in terms of their own country. They still think that the opposition to the military and the government are basically communists and that they're backed by Castro. And I don't think Castro has enough money. I know Castro doesn't have enough money to take care of the concerns in his own country. He certainly doesn't have any money to foment and export any sort of sense of revolution. Right? Everybody knows that, including the CIA. But right, it still works in Guatemala. Oh, it worked in the U.S. for a long, long time, but they're still using that down there, and it's still working. And it's again that link of anti-communism with these fundamentalist groups, these fundamentalist sects, that is a very dominant force within Guatemala right now. But I mean, again, this person, who quite frankly I would characterize as a butcher, is, right, a real Bible thumping fundamentalist Assembly of God person. Right? He thought that what he was doing here was indeed God's will. Right? To rid Guatemala of these godless pagan indigenous peoples.
So what's a Lutheran to do?
That's interesting. Well, what?
Well, that was the question I was going to ask. Where's this middle ground between that? Fundamentalism And where was the Lutheran Church, or where are we now? Where is the church dealing with life in its more real terms of the faith? And still dealing with the problems of people of faith since, but good, in their own situation.
Good question.
One thing I think the Catholic Church did with that catechist movement was to let the people know that they had a little power because they were so totally victimized.
Right.
By the operators of that thinker. And it seemed to me, just from reading Mencius' book, that that church, much as I would disagree with them, gave much to the people by teaching them how to have a communication system, by teaching that they did have some power, by educating people in little spots all through that area. And so they sense even a social meaning to their lives and a little political power. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how much religion they preached.
And that Pope did not support this. I mean,
right. I mean, yes, that's true. That's true. And I mean, the very ironies that when people in Poland were doing the exact same thing against the Polish government, which of course was communist, they were extolled and encouraged by the Pope to keep it up. When in the same kind of situation in Central America, only now the government is not necessarily communist, but certainly just as exploitative and repressing, they are chastised by the Pope because, again, that whole Cold War mentality, he saw the opposition as basically leftist, Marxist, and again, I think that's an unfortunate caricature. It's not really true in many cases, and therefore it was condemned. Where are the churches right now? I think that, again, many of the churches have... particularly in Guatemala, have in the middle, again, are concerned with social justice, but the label under which it now goes is called a theology of life. And even in El Salvador, someone like Bishop Medardo Gomez has a little book out now too where he talks about the theology of life. The theology of life is just the, this is maybe too glib, but I'll say it, is just the repackaging of the theology of liberation in a term that the opposition does not find as offensive. Because, right, they can be against liberation as, right, revolutionary and upheaval and all of that. But you see, again, it's pretty hard for the Roman Catholic Church or anyone else to come out and say, well, you see, I'm against life. Or to say, well, you see, life is revolutionary, and so down with it. It just doesn't work as well. So that this is now understood as a safer category. Whether it is or isn't, again, there can be, and there is a lot of discussion about that. But what that theology of life entails, just like liberation theology entails, is first of all, that sense of the conscientization of the people. I'm sure you've heard, or maybe not. I think this would be the best anglicized way of it. Conscientization, right? Making people conscientious about their own situation, right? What's going on? A part of that will involve literacy, right? Just simply teaching people how to read. Part of that entails letting people know of their human rights. That yes, there are laws and there are rights, and folks just can't ride roughshod over you. And if they do, that needs to be reported. Reported to the agencies of the United Nations, to Oxfam, to Amnesty International, to church groups and whatnot, so that is known. You have rights, and when you think they are violated, make that known. That's all part of conscientization. What follows from that, and I think this is the stage that they're in now in Guatemala,
is organization. And this is what's so troubling to the military and others, that because now, right, when you get organized, right, you start to come together and you find out, hey, other folks are in the same situation that I am. And that while maybe I can't do it alone, or maybe while our one little group, our one little village can't do it alone, when all the villages join together, when all the internally displaced peoples of Guatemala join together in a big organization of the internally displaced peoples of Guatemala and now protest, there's some clout behind that, right? There's over 1 million people there. So again, part of what the church is doing in its social justice capacity is not only continuing its sense of conscientization, but also helping and enabling this organization to go on and acting as a channel for other international groups and agencies to come in and help and provide their kind of expertise, as well as to be one of the credible witnesses in terms of making sure that the human rights of the people are protected. I know that that when these folks return from Mexico, to make sure that nothing happens to them along the way, there are our UN convoys, the High Commission on Human Rights and Refugees is there, as well as groups from the World Council of Churches and the Lutheran World Federation and the Catholic Civil Rights. Those three groups, WCC, LWF, and Catholic Civil Rights, or human rights agencies, always accompany these returning. So that the third kind of understanding here is to say where the church is in terms of this, is they understand their role as a ministry of accompaniment. In other words, it's not, you know, kind of an old style paternalism, you know, there, we know you're poor and you're ignorant and you can't do anything, so we'll do it for you. It's not any sense of we'll do it for you. But as you determine your life and your destiny and your living in the world, we will work with you. We will accompany you. Right. We will be there to support you when you need that support. Right. And again, it's very obvious, the military usually, right, will not do to internationals what they would do to their own people. Right. Now, sometimes that's not the case. Occasionally, again, you hear of an international who is killed or disappeared or whatnot, or to think back to El Salvador, the four Catholic workers, three nuns and lay person who were killed on the road from the Salvadoran airport into San Salvador back in 1976, I think. Right. So I mean, occasionally it does happen. But usually it's not the case, right? Again, because that's far too risky. I mean, you kill an international and you've got the wrath of the international community in a, or at least, right, immediately there are calls for investigations and what, you know, quite frankly, they don't want people nosing around in their business too much. So, you know, they have to grit their teeth and say, well, somehow we got to put up with this. They don't like it, but they have to put up with it.
In effect, then, whether you agree with these trade agreements or not, they in effect have done some good to help the cause of democracy in South America.
Yes and no. They have done some good in saying they need democracy for political stability. And therefore, they have opened up a political space for human rights. That's where they have done some good. They have not done any good in terms of
what free trade entails for these countries is the notion of structural adjustment. And structural adjustment has just been devastating to all of the economies of Central America, Latin America, anywhere where that policy has been put in place. Do you know what I mean by structural adjustment?
Well, I presume you mean reorganization of their whole infrastructure.
Right. Right. Structural adjustment. I've got about 5 minutes. Structural adjustment is the big buzzword in the international money community, the International Monetary Fund (IMF), the World Bank, and USAID are all into structural adjustment. And what structural adjustment entails, very brief, it's about three things. First, it's you have to change your thinking that you need to not think about being a self-sufficient economy, with whatever that means. But the thing is, you've got to have the transfer and flow of capital from weak and its surplus from weak to strong capital. And so that means you have to turn all of your economies into export economies. So in other words, to say, and this is particularly happening in Nicaragua with the election of Violeta Chamorro in 1990. Immediately the U.S. came in there, World Bank came in there and said structural adjustment. So what that means is, no, you don't think about how can we raise corn, rice, beans and cattle to feed our people, you think about how can we raise coffee, strawberries, cabbages, cotton, whatever things we can export to bring in the greatest flow of capital possible.
And investment,
because by thinking, bringing that in, it'll mean investment. That's the way then you can build an infrastructure. There's one problem with that, is that what free trade has done and what globalization does is make capital more mobile than ever. And so the capital just simply flows through the country, and the people who still have these mechanisms for the capital, the banks, the landowners, the marketing agencies, that just flows in, and if they don't see it as a possible continuing market venture there, it flows right out to other market ventures or to banks in Miami and Bahamas or whatever. The capital doesn't stay in the country. So that this whole export economy, these countries are now capitally poorer than they've ever been.
They're also finding that tends to concentrate the power into the wealth power into a lesser number of individuals.
Into a lesser number of individuals, so that
then limiting the middle class.
So that what has happened is that with this now, indeed with structural adjustment and globalization of trade, the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer, and the middle class is disappearing.
And there are fewer richer.
And the kind of scary thing and warning, quite frankly, is to say, as the United States, Canada, other countries continue to engage in that, what's happening in like Central America will be happening in our countries as well. We've just maybe got 20 years yet before it's going to hit us hard.
But we've seen it in the last couple of years.
There is truly a disappearing of the middle class, and the rift is getting greater. The United Nations report on human development in 1993, their front cover had a chart on wealth distribution, and they called it, its figure was the champagne glass, right? And here the poorest of the world, here are the richest, and the figure is just like a, and what's happening
is that the stem, they're projections, right? The stem is getting longer and longer, and this glass will be getting shallower and shallower. In other words, what's happening is that greater and greater wealth is concentrated in the hands of fewer and fewer people.
That's what they're finding.
Right. That's and that's a global phenomenon. But of course, where it's hitting first are countries of the two-thirds world. So basically, in that sense, what we are seeing in a country like Nicaragua or Guatemala is what our country could be 20, 30 years from now.
Awesome. One of the questions I wanted to ask about this, so the words are sounding better, theology, life, and comfort, et cetera, but in practice, many of the times, in many parts of the world, Lutherans and the Catholics have been the trusted people who went for relief, as seen as not a threat by governments for the opposition, since they're not, quote, the instigators, and seen as separate yet, and partly for all the reasons you mentioned as well. But, and so with this, and I'm not, you know, so what? When I say, what is the church doing? Okay, so that's fine. How is the church being perceived? In other words, is the government perceiving that in fact, or are we in fact doing that? Are we the people who are saying, hey, come on, you guys got to organize? But when you're saying, when we're approaches, we're accompanying, we're letting them determine, be more self-determined, be responsible, then trying to assist them, being there on the road, is the government also seeing us more in that light, or still, as we were in the past, being the instigators? We had a history there for a while of really getting our finger in the middle of the pie and sticking it in the program.
Yeah. In talking with the people in the Guatemalan government, they right now have a high level of paranoia. They think everyone is out to get them, right? All the international communities are out to get them. The United Nations is out to get them. They don't understand. The churches are out to get them. They don't understand. The United States government is out to get them. They don't understand. As the pitch came, you know, this was the Assistant Secretary of Foreign Relations, when we met with him for over an hour, a very interesting revisionist history. But I mean, it's to summarize it, he simply said to us, well, we just don't understand. Guatemala has always been the good neighbor to the United States. Whatever you've wanted, we in Guatemala have always been more than ready to do and accommodate. And yet, it always seems like it's the wrong thing and it's never enough. And now you want us to do this democratization and demilitarization and you know, risk our own health and welfare and well-being. We just don't understand that. Would you please make up your mind? You know, little zinger there. That was so that even the U.S. government is perceived now by those in power as the enemy. But of course, they've got to be placated because these folks are smart enough to know if you go against the U.S., you're done for. So it's how do we play the game? And yes, we're going to have to make some significant sacrifices and give up some power. But again, these are smart, conniving people. But we can also figure out whatever loopholes and whatever is necessary to certainly make sure we maintain the wealth. Right? That's what's important.
My belief has always been in these situations that the role of the church for the betterment of the faith, for the growth of the faith, is the ministry is really to all, because that would include those in power. Mm-hmm. So rather than being on sides. So that the role will be there to, they have a dilemma as well.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And if the church could be perceived as being trusted by all, maybe not. You see what I'm driving at? Where we can be that something else then that is of this world. We are in the world. We are not of the world. We are apart.
Right.
And that is what I am again hearing and seeing so much.
And I think that I mean, yes, there's again, on the one hand, the government and the military does not see the church as its friend because obviously the church does not agree with its policies. That does not mean that the church cannot minister to them, but I would say at that point, the church is exercising a prophetic voice. On the other hand, when it does come to accompaniment, when it does come to, right, if the government would have their druthers, who is it that we would want to see, bring these refugees back and accompany them and make sure their human rights are not violated and so on and so forth? The government would rather have church organizations rather than any other organization.
Okay,
why? Because the church has no...